I want you to imagine holding a delicate, perfectly clear glass of water right in your hand. Just really feel the weight of it.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Good. Now, I want you to imagine just opening your hand and letting it drop onto a hard tile floor.
Oh, well, I know exactly what happens next.
Right, we all do. It shatters into this chaotic mess. Water splashes everywhere, soaking into the grout. Shards of glass scatter in completely random directions, you know, sliding under the fridge, bouncing off the cabinets.
Yeah, it's a complete mess.
Exactly. It is a strict one-way street from order to absolute disorder. We just accept that. It's how the universe works. You don't even think twice about it.
No, you definitely don't.
But now, I want you to imagine watching that exact same process, but in reverse.
In reverse.
Yeah. Imagine standing in your kitchen and watching water droplets perfectly coalescing, pulling back together from across the floor, totally defying gravity to form a perfect sphere.
That's an incredibly jarring image to hold in your mind.
It really is. Imagine the glass fragments sliding across the tile, reassembling themselves, reforming the exact shape of a cup without a single microscopic crack, and then jumping right back up into your hand.
We are so instinctively accustomed to things breaking down, you know, to systems degrading over time. Physicists refer to this as the arrow of time, which is driven by entropy.
Right, the natural slide into chaos.
Exactly. So the idea of an entire system spontaneously leaping into a state of hyperordered perfection feels like this deep violation of common sense. You would
Yeah.
immediately assume you were watching a movie being played backward.
You really would. That reversed image, that sudden and impossible return to perfect order, is exactly what we expect the universe not to do. We expect the bomb to go off and leave a crater, not a pristine building.
Right.
But what if the very origin of our universe, the actual beginning of everything we know, did the exact opposite of what we expect from a massive explosion?
Well, when we look deeply into the foundational physics of our origin, and I mean really strip away the everyday assumptions to look at the bare mathematics of the Big Bang, a picture emerges that is far closer to the glass reassembling itself than shattering.
Which is just wild to think about.
It is. It's a picture of astonishing, almost uncomfortable precision.
And that deeply uncomfortable mind-bending picture is exactly what we are exploring today. Welcome to this deep dive into a profoundly fascinating text called The Origin Enigma.
Yes, and we're going to be looking at some really compelling stuff today.
We really are. We are focusing heavily on the first chapter, which is titled The Cosmic Framework, alongside a few complementary visual and conceptual models that the author uses to help, you know, help beginners wrap their heads around these incredibly vast concepts.
And we should probably state our intentions clearly up front for everyone listening, because the arguments presented in this text touch on some of the absolute deepest philosophical questions humans have ever asked.
Totally. Our mission today is not to tell you what to believe about the origins of reality. We aren't theologians, and we aren't here to push a specific worldview on you.
No, not at all.
Our goal is to objectively, rigorously unpack the author's mathematical and physical case for teleology. And teleology is really just a fancy word for the idea of purposeful design or direction in nature.
Exactly.
The author builds this entire case by looking at what modern physicists call cosmic fine-tuning. We are going to explore just how precariously calibrated the initial conditions of the Big Bang had to be for you to literally be sitting here listening to this right now.
We're basically going to lay out the author's arguments, impartially reporting on the content provided in these source materials. We're just acting as your guide.
Just your guides through the physics.
Okay.
Let's unpack this, because to really get where the author is coming from, this deep dive begins before we even talk about stars or galaxies or even matter itself.
Right. It starts with the abstract.
Yeah, the author starts with philosophical and historical foundation, specifically highlighting a physicist named Eugene Wigner. Back in 1960, Wigner wrote this famous, almost provocative paper about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics.
Which is such a great phrase.
It really is. He observed that abstract math, you know, stuff created purely in the human mind, often without the mathematician ever looking at nature or trying to solve a real-world physical problem, routinely turns out to perfectly describe physical reality later on.
And Wigner's observation is crucial here because it points to a deep underlying rationality in the cosmos that we tend to just take for granted.
We really do.
To understand why this is so strange, think about it from a purely unguided materialist perspective. If the universe is fundamentally just a chaotic, random fluctuation of matter and energy like a cosmic accident, there is absolutely no logical reason why human abstract reasoning should perfectly map onto the deep cosmic laws of physics.
Right, because our brains evolved to do completely different things.
Exactly. Our brains, presumably, evolved to help us find fruit and avoid predators on the savannah. They did not evolve to understand the quantum tunneling of electrons or the curvature of four-dimensional space-time.
So it's basically like someone writing a completely fictional, made-up fantasy language in their basement, just for fun.
Uh-huh.
And then they travel to a newly discovered continent on the other side of the world and find out all the locals there speak that exact made-up language perfectly.
That analogy actually captures the bewilderment physicists felt perfectly. A historical example of this, which the author uses to support Wigger 2-point, is non-Euclidean geometry.
Oh, right. The math that broke Euclid's rules.
Yes. So for thousands of years, mathematicians relied on Euclid's geometry. One of his absolute rules was the parallel postulate. The idea that parallel lines never meet.
Standard high school geometry stuff.
Right. But in the 19th century, mathematicians like Gauss, Lobachevsky, and Riemann started playing around with geometries where that rule was broken, where parallel lines could converge or diverge.
But just as a mental exercise, right? Yeah. They were basically just playing a game with numbers.
Completely. It was considered pure abstract mathematics with zero application to the real world because everyone thought the real world was flat and Cartesian.
And then Einstein comes along.
Exactly. Decades later, Albert Einstein is trying to formulate his theory of general relativity. He realizes that gravity isn't just a pull, it's the actual warping and curving of space-time.
Wow.
But he doesn't have the mathematical language to describe a curved universe until he realizes that Riemann had already invented it decades earlier, purely in his imagination. The math was sitting there waiting for the physics to catch up.
That is just wild. Or another example is like the Fibonacci sequence showing up in the spiral arms of galaxies or the arrangement of seeds in the sunflower.
Yes, exactly.
Why does the universe obey the abstract thoughts in our heads? But let me push back a bit here on behalf of you, the listener, because whenever I hear this, my skeptic alarm just immediately goes off.
Sure, that's natural.
Is this really evidence of a target or a design? Or is it just a massive case of cognitive bias, specifically like the Texas sharpshooter fallacy?
Oh, right.
Are we just shooting a bunch of math equations at the wall, walking up to the ones that happen to stick, painting a bullseye around them, and just completely ignoring all the thousands of mathematical concepts that don't map onto reality?
It's a very fair critique. It really is the standard counterargument. But the author addresses this by diving into the historical context of how physics developed in the 20th century.
Okay.
The realization of fine-tuning didn't start as a philosophical theory looking for a justification. It started as hard, inescapable data that made physicists deeply uncomfortable.
Like they were finding things they didn't want to find.
Exactly. In 1919, the mathematician Hermann Weyl noticed these strange, inexplicable coincidences in the ratios of electromagnetic and gravitational forces. He saw numbers that had no business being related, just perfectly aligning.
And it kept compounding, right? It wasn't just a one-off?
It did. By 1961, the physicist Robert Dicke pointed out something astonishing about the age of the universe. People always wondered why the universe was so incredibly old and so vast.
Right.
Dicke pointed out that the universe has to be exactly as old as it is to support observers.
Why is that?
Because you need enough time for the very first generation of stars to form, live out their billions of years of life, and then explode in supernovae to cook up heavy elements like carbon and iron.
Oh, I see.
If the universe were younger, those elements literally wouldn't exist. And therefore, biological life couldn't exist to even ask the question.
Right, which all culminated in the 1980s. The text mentions a foundational 1986 book by John Barrow and Frank Tipler on the anthropic principle.
Yes, and we really should clarify what the anthropic principle actually is because it gets misunderstood a lot.
Yeah, let's define that.
The weak anthropic principle basically just says what we can expect to observe must be restricted by the conditions necessary for our presence as observers. It's almost a tautology.
Like, obviously. Of course, we observe a universe capable of supporting life.
Mm.
If it weren't, we wouldn't be here to observe it.
Right. It's like saying the only type of fish you can catch in a net with 2-inch holes are fish larger than 2 inches.
Okay, yeah. It doesn't explain the ocean itself. It just explains the limitation of your net.
Exactly. But Barrow and Tipler went much further than that. They detail how incredibly restrictive those conditions actually are. What started as a minor mathematical curiosity literally became a crisis for cosmological models relying purely on unguided chance.
The physics itself was screaming that the parameters were inexplicably precise.
Yes. It wasn't cognitive bias, because these mathematical models weren't just describing things after the fact. They were making highly specific, risky predictions about the universe that turned out to be completely true.
So the alignment between math and reality is the abstract framework.
Yeah.
The blueprints, so to speak. But blueprints don't build a house. For anything to actually exist within that framework, for you or me to be having this conversation, or for a galaxy to spin there, it first has to be stuff.
Uh-huh.
We need raw material.
We need matter.
Exactly. Which means we have to clear the first massive physical hurdle the author lays out.
Yeah.
The sheer existence of matter itself.
Yeah.
The survival of substance.
This is perhaps the most foundational prerequisite for life, and one that we walk around taking entirely for granted every single day.
I know I do.
The text explains that the Big Bang, according to our very best standard models of particle physics, should have produced perfectly equal amounts of matter and antimatter.
Okay, let's slow down there. For anyone who might not be a particle physicist, what exactly is antimatter? Because it sounds like something straight out of Star Trek.
It does, but it's very real. The physicist Paul Dirac mathematically predicted it before it was ever even discovered. Essentially, for every fundamental particle of matter, like an electron, there exists a corresponding particle of antimatter, a positron. It has the exact same mass, but the opposite electrical charge. The real problem is how they interact.
Right. When matter and antimatter meet, it's not exactly a friendly handshake. They don't just bounce off each other.
No, they completely annihilate each other. Utter annihilation. It is the ultimate expression of Einstein's E equals mc squared. 100% of their mass is converted instantly into pure energy in the form of high energy photons or gamma radiation.
Just totally wiped out.
Yes. So if exact symmetry is the natural, elegant default of physics, if the Big Bang created 50% matter and 50% antimatter, then they all should have bumped into each other in the dense early universe and vanished.
Leaving what, exactly?
Leaving nothing but a sterile, lifeless void of light expanding into the dark. There should be zero atoms, zero stars, zero planets, and absolutely zero chemistry.
Just a bath of radiation.
Just an endless bath of cooling radiation.
But obviously, I'm looking at you right now. My microphone is made of matter. The device you, listening to this, are holding is made of matter. How did any of this survive that great annihilation?
The author highlights a staggering data point here. Our universe and everything in it survived because of a microscopic, almost imperceptible imbalance in those earliest moments.
Imbalance.
Yes. For reasons standard physics still struggles to fully explain, there was a tiny asymmetry. Roughly one extra matter particle was created for every 1 billion antimatter particles.
One in a billion.
Yes, just one. The vast, overwhelming majority of the universe's material did exactly what we expected. It annihilated itself. The entire visible universe today, every single galaxy, every star, every planet, and every biological organism is essentially the leftover residue, the tiny sliver of ash from this one in a billion primordial imbalance.
Okay, I want to make sure I'm wrapping my head around this. Let's say I'm running a massive global bank.
Right.
And I have a ledger with $1 billion in credits and exactly $1 billion in debits. They cancel each other out perfectly to zero. But wait, I made a tiny typo. It was actually $1 billion in credits. So the accounts annihilate, and I'm left with exactly one single dollar. And what the author is saying is that this one leftover dollar is the entire physical universe. We are literally the rounding error.
Your analogy captures the scale of the asymmetry perfectly, but calling it an error is precisely where the author pushes back.
Really?
Yes. An error implies a mistake in an otherwise expected system. The author asks us to look at the result. That quote-unquote error happens to be the exact quantity of matter required to eventually form stars capable of sustaining nuclear fusion long enough for biology to take hold.
Okay, but let me put my skeptic hat back on. Let's say you're right. It's an incredibly precise imbalance. But why couldn't there just be a physics rule, like a mechanism we just haven't discovered yet, that naturally favors matter over antimatter?
It's a common objection.
Like, maybe it's not fine-tuning your design. Maybe it's just a missing equation in our textbook that forces this asymmetry.
What's fascinating here is how the author anticipates and systematically dismantles that exact counter-argument.
Oh, they do?
Yes. Let's grant your premise. Let's say tomorrow, a brilliant physicist at CERN discovers a new underlying fundamental law that naturally forces the universe to produce one extra matter particle per billion. The author argues that this doesn't actually solve the fine-tuning problem. It merely moves it down a layer.
How so? If we have a rule for it, isn't the mystery solved?
Because you then have to ask the next logical question. Why does the universe happen to possess a foundational law that is calibrated so perfectly?
Oh, I see.
Why does the rule dictate a 1 in a billion asymmetry rather than a 1 in a million or a 1 in a trillion? If the mechanism produced too much matter, the universe would be too dense and would collapse under its own gravity too quickly.
And if it produced too little?
Matter would be too diffuse to ever form galaxies. Even if a physical mechanism is found, the precision of the outcome dictated by that mechanism still represents extreme fine-tuning. You haven't explained away the tuning. You've just found the dial that was tuned.
That makes a lot of sense. You're just shifting the goalposts from the result to the rule governing the result. Okay, so we've cleared the first hurdle. We have matter. We survive the antimatter annihilation phase. But a universe filled with just a silent, expanding cloud of hydrogen gas doesn't make a deep dive audio show.
No, it certainly isn't.
It doesn't make stars or human beings. For that matter, to actually build something, the particles need to talk to each other. They need rules of engagement. They need to stick together, repel each other, and burn. And the rules governing those interactions, according to the source material, are balancing on a razor's edge.
And that takes us directly into the heart of the physics, the four fundamental forces. Gravity, electromagnetism, the strong nuclear force, and the weak nuclear force.
The four invisible pillars holding up physical reality.
Yes. And the text details the catastrophic consequences of altering the strength of any of these forces by even the most infinitesimal margins.
Let's walk through them because this is where the numbers start getting really crazy. Let's start with the one we all know, gravity.
Okay.
The author states that the strength of gravity must be exactly 10 to the power of minus 40 times the strength of electromagnetism.
Yes, it does.
Which is an absurdly small fraction. I mean, we're talking 0. followed by 39 zeros and then a 1. Why does gravity have to be so incredibly weak compared to a magnet?
To understand why, you have to look at how a star works. A star, like our sun, is essentially a billion-year-long tug of war.
A tug of war.
Right. You have the immense mass of all that hydrogen gas pulling inward due to gravity, trying to crush the star into a single point. Fighting against that, pushing outward, is the explosive energy of nuclear fusion happening in the core. It's a delicate equilibrium.
So gravity pulls in, fusion blows out.
Precisely. Now, if gravity were just a slightly stronger, even a fraction of percent stronger than that 10 to the minus 40 ratio, it would pull inward far more aggressively.
Crushing it more.
Yes. The core of the star would be under vastly more pressure, which means it would burn through its nuclear fuel incredibly fast. Instead of our sun living for 10 billion years, giving life plenty of time to evolve on Earth, it might burn out and collapse in a few million years.
Wow. So no time for evolution.
Exactly. Conversely, if gravity were just slightly weaker, the gas clouds in the early universe wouldn't have enough gravitational pull to compress the hydrogen tightly enough to ignite nuclear fusion in the first place.
So the stars just don't turn on.
No stars ever ignite. You just get dark, cold clouds of gas drifting forever. No heat, no light, no heavy elements.
Okay, let me try an analogy here.
Yeah.
It's like you're a sound engineer in a high-end recording studio. You're looking at a massive mixing board.
I like this.
But this board only have four dials on it, one for each fundamental force. So I step up to the gravity dial. If I nudge it a millimeter to the left, making it weaker, the song just stops playing. The universe goes dark.
Right.
If I nudge it a millimeter to the right, making it stronger, the speakers literally blow out and catch fire because the stars burn up instantly.
You're definitely on the right track with the catastrophic consequences of turning the dials, but the soundboard analogy actually misses a crucial layer of the author's argument.
How so?
The dials aren't independent. It's not just about setting gravity to the right spot. It's about setting it relative to all the other dials. Which brings us to the strong nuclear force.
Right. This is the force that acts like the glue holding the nucleus of an atom together, binding protons and neutrons.
Yes. And the text points out something truly extraordinary about how this force relates to carbon. Carbon is the essential scaffolding for all known organic chemistry. No carbon, no life, period.
Right.
But carbon isn't created in the Big Bang. It's forged in the hearts of dying stars.
And how exactly does the strong nuclear force control that? Why is it so sensitive?
Well, it's because of how carbon is actually built in a star. To make a carbon-12 atom, a star has to smash three helium-4 nuclei together. But getting three to hit at the exact same fraction of a second is, you know, incredibly unlikely.
Right, like a three-way car crash.
Exactly. So the star does it in steps. Two heliums fuse to make beryllium-8. And then a third helium hits the beryllium to make carbon.
Seems straightforward enough.
You'd think so. But beryllium-8 is incredibly unstable. It decays back into helium in a fraction of a nanosecond. It's a massive bottleneck.
Oh, wow.
The only way carbon can form before the beryllium falls apart is if the energy levels of the beryllium, the helium, and the resulting carbon perfectly align in what physicists call a resonance. It's sort of like acoustic resonance. You know, when you hit a certain note, a glass shatters because it absorbs the energy perfectly.
I've seen videos of that.
Right. Well, in the 1950s, the astronomer Fred Hoyle realized that for carbon to exist, carbon-12 must have an undiscovered, highly specific resonance energy level. He predicted it based purely on the fact that we exist.
Wait, he used our existence as a mathematical proof.
He did. And nuclear physicists went into the lab and actually found it. They call it the Hoyle state. Now, back to fine-tuning. The exact position of that resonance depends entirely on the strength of the strong nuclear force.
Oh, no.
Yes. If you alter the strong nuclear force by as little as 0.5%, you shift the resonance. The beryllium bottleneck closes entirely. No carbon is produced in the universe. None.
0.5% change in the fundamental glue of reality, and the entire periodic table loses its most important building block. That is terrifyingly precise.
It really is.
And the text also gets into the masses of the particles themselves, doesn't it? Not just the forces, but the actual building blocks.
Yes. The proton-neutron mass difference. The mass of a neutron is ever so slightly heavier than the mass of a proton. That mass difference is meticulously tuned to roughly 1 part in 1,000.
And if we change that dial, say we make the neutron slightly lighter.
If the neutron were lighter than the proton would become unstable. The laws of physics dictate that heavier particles naturally decay into lighter ones, so protons would rapidly decay into neutrons.
But a proton is the nucleus of a hydrogen atom.
Exactly. If protons decay, hydrogen ceases to exist. Hydrogen is water. Hydrogen is the primary fuel for stars. If you change that mass difference by a fraction of a percent, the elemental diversity of the universe just vanishes. You don't get a slightly different universe, you get a dead universe.
So going back to my mixing board. It's not just that moving the dial blows out the speakers. It's that if you move the strong nuclear force dial, you also have to perfectly readjust the gravity dial and the electromagnetism dial just to keep the whole system from crashing.
Right. They form an interconnected web.
That's insane.
That is the core of Barrow and Tipler's anthropic analysis. The safe zones for habitability aren't just narrow lines on a graph. They are unimaginably small, multidimensional intersections of all these different constraints. The universe is walking a tightrope where the tension of the rope, the wind speed, the gravity of the planet, and the molecular structure of the rope itself all have to be perfectly synchronized simultaneously from the first nanosecond of existence.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because we've built surviving matter, and we've established the razor's edge forces that bind it together and make it do interesting things like forge carbon in the Hoyle state.
Yes.
But all of this matter and all of these forces need a stage to play on. They need an environment. We have to zoom out to the grandest scale of all, looking at the geometry and the expansion of the space in which all this actually exists.
We are moving from the microscopic to the macroscopic. This brings us to the cosmological constant, which is often associated with dark energy.
Dark energy, the mysterious force pushing the universe apart.
Yes. It represents the intrinsic energy density of the vacuum of space itself. It acts as a repulsive gravity, governing the rate at which the universe is expanding. The text states that this expansion rate is fine-tuned to 1 part in 10 to the power of 120.
Okay, stop right there. 1 part in 10 to the power of 120, that is a 1. With 120 zeros after it.
It is a number so large that the human brain literally lacks the evolutionary hardware to comprehend it.
I mean, I need some context for that. How precise is that, really?
Well, consider this. There are roughly 10 to the power of 80 fundamental particles, protons, neutrons, electrons, in the entire observable universe. So 10 to the 120 is 40 orders of magnitude greater than the number of particles that exist.
That's, I don't even have a word for that.
This level of fine-tuning is infinitely more precise than asking you to blindly pick a single specific atom out of the entire cosmos on your first try.
But what are the physical stakes of this number? Like, what is the cosmological constant actually doing?
It is dictating the tug of war of cosmic expansion. If the cosmological constant is too positive, if that outward push is too strong, space expands so violently and rapidly that gravity never has a chance to pull matter together.
So things just fly apart.
The universe literally rips itself apart, expanding so fast that gas never condenses into galaxies. It diffuses into a rapidly freezing, lonely void.
And if it's too negative, if the dial is turned the other way,
then the vacuum has a strong attractive force. The universe might begin to expand after the Big Bang, but it instantly hits a wall, reverses, and recollapses in on itself. A cosmic crunch.
So everything is crushed.
Everything is crushed into a singular black hole before any long-lived structure can even begin to develop. It has to be balanced to a precision of 10 to the 1 in 20 to allow the universe to expand slowly enough for gravity to clump matter into galaxies, but fast enough not to instantly collapse.
It's like balancing a pencil on its incredibly sharp tip.
Mm-hmm.
But not just balancing it on a desk. It's like balancing a pencil on its tip while that pencil is sitting on a tray in a bullet train, when a bullet train is speeding over a bridge during a magnitude 9 earthquake.
That's a great visual.
And somehow, the pencil never drops.
It's a vivid analogy, and the text compounds this fragility by looking at the very dimensions of space itself. The author cites a foundational proof by the physicist Paul Ehrenfest regarding dimensionality.
Right, we live in a 3D world. Up and down, left and right, forward and backward. I've always just assumed that's the only way a universe could be.
Ehrenfest proved mathematically that it is the only way a habitable universe can be. He showed that only exactly 3 extended spatial dimensions allow for stable physical structures.
Why? What goes wrong in 4 dimensions?
It fundamentally alters how forces propagate through space. In our 3-dimensional universe, gravity and electromagnetism follow an inverse square law. That geometry is what allows a planet to find a stable, repeating elliptical orbit around a star.
Okay.
If you add a fourth spatial dimension, the math changes. Forces would propagate according to an inverse cube law. The gravitational pull would drop off much faster over distance.
Meaning orbits wouldn't work?
They would become wildly unstable. Planets would either slowly spiral inward and be incinerated by their suns, or a slight perturbation would cause them to fly off into deep freezing space.
Oh.
Furthermore, Ehrenfest and subsequent physicists have pointed out that 3 dimensions are uniquely required for the complex topological wiring of neural networks.
Neural networks, meaning the physical structure of a brain.
Exactly. You can't wire a sufficiently complex brain in 2 dimensions without the neural pathways physically crossing and short-circuiting each other. You need the 3rd dimension to run wires over and under one another.
That makes perfect sense.
But 4 dimensions introduces fundamental instabilities at the atomic level that prevent complex molecules from holding their structure. 3 dimensions is the absolute Goldilocks zone for biology.
And we haven't even mentioned the primordial density, which the author calls Q.
Yes, the ratio of the gravitational energy of the universe to its expansion energy, tuned to 10 to the minus 5. Again, a little higher, everything collapses into black holes. A little lower, nothing condenses.
As these numbers, 1 in 10 to the 120, 10 to the minus 5, the strict requirement of 3 dimensions as they start to compound, it really does strain human comprehension.
It pushes us to the limit.
But reading the text, I realized this is all actually just setting you, the listener, up for the absolute biggest, most mind-boggling, reality-breaking number in the entire source material. Because everything we have discussed so far concerns the laws of physics and the constants of nature.
That's a crucial distinction. Laws are just descriptions of behavior.
Right. The rules of chess don't start the game of chess. Laws need something to act upon. They need an initial starting state, an environment to govern. Which brings us to the climax of the cosmic framework, the exact, precise starting state of the Big Bang itself, the initial entropy problem.
This is the centerpiece of the author's argument. It draws heavily on the deeply complex calculations performed by the renowned Oxford mathematical physicist Sir Roger Penrose.
Okay.
To fully grasp Penrose's calculation, we need to dive into thermodynamics, specifically the concept of entropy.
I feel like entropy is a word that gets thrown around a lot in pop science, but usually just as a synonym for messy. What is it, actually?
In physics, entropy is a rigorous mathematical measure of the number of ways you can arrange the microscopic components of a system without changing its macroscopic appearance. Simply put, it's a measure of disorder, randomness, and thermal equilibrium.
Okay.
The second law of thermodynamics dictates that closed systems naturally and inevitably move from low entropy, which is order, to high entropy, which is disorder.
This goes right back to the hook we opened the show with. The glass of water naturally shatters into chaos. A shattered glass never spontaneously reassembles itself, because there are billions of ways for the glass to be broken, but only one highly specific way for it to be a perfect cup.
Precisely. Now, we have to apply that law to the birth of the universe. The Big Bang was the ultimate explosion. It was the most violent, energetic, disruptive event in the history of physical reality.
Explosions break things.
Exactly. Logically, thermodynamically, an explosion of that magnitude should have produced a state of absolute maximum disorder. It should have immediately hit what physicists call thermal equilibrium.
So just chaos right from the start.
The universe should have been a high entropy state from fraction of a second zero. A chaotic, completely uniform plasma with no structure, no differences in temperature, and no usable energy gradients.
Let me make sure I'm following. If the early universe was completely uniform, just a perfectly even hot soup, nothing could ever happen, right?
Yeah.
Because to do work, you need energy to flow. Mm-hmm. And to get energy to flow, you need hot spots and cold spots. You need differences.
That is the key. You need a gradient. For gravity to eventually pull matter into stars, for those stars to radiate heat into the cold void of space, for an arrow of time to push forward, and for any complex chemistry to occur on a planet, the universe had to start in an exceptionally low entropy state.
Highly ordered.
It had to begin incredibly, almost impossibly highly ordered, so that it had a reservoir of order to slowly burn through over the next 14 billion years.
So Penrose wanted to calculate exactly how special that initial starting condition was. How mathematically precise did that initial ordered state have to be to allow for a universe like ours?
Yes. And to do this, Penrose utilized a concept called phase space.
Let's explain that, because the visual prompts the source material uses for this are brilliant, but we need to explain what the phase space actually represents.
Phase space is a theoretical, multidimensional, mathematical space where every single possible state of a system is represented by a single point. So imagine mapping out every possible way you could arrange the energy, the matter, the expansion rate, and the temperature of the Big Bang.
So it's basically a map of all possible universes.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
Now, because an explosion naturally creates chaos, the overwhelming, almost entirely absolute majority of this phase space represents high entropy, chaotic, dead universes. Let's use the visual analogy from the text to make this concrete.
Okay, I want you listening to picture this. Imagine an infinite grid, an endless dark space extending infinitely in all directions, filled with glowing dots. This is our phase space grid.
Right.
Each dot represents one possible way the Big Bang could have gone down. Because physics strongly favors disorder, almost all of these dots, an infinite ocean of them, are glowing red. A red dot is a dead, chaotic, high-entropy universe where nothing interesting ever happens. According to Penrose's rigorous calculation, out of this endless sea of red dots, there is only one single dot glowing blue. That one solitary blue dot represents the specific, highly ordered, life-permitting initial state that we actually live in.
The author offers another profound analogy to illustrate the categorical absurdity of finding that blue dot by chance. It highlights the difference between what thermodynamics dictates we expect and what we actually observe in cosmology.
Oh, the bomb analogy.
Yes. When you drop a massive hydrogen bomb on an empty desert, the laws of physics dictate the outcome. You get a massive crater, blinding heat, and a wasteland of disordered radioactive rubble. That is maximum entropy.
That's what an explosion does.
Yes. Penrose's calculation shows that the Big Bang was the equivalent of detonating that hydrogen bomb, waiting for the blinding flash to subside, and when the smoke finally clears, you look down and you don't find a crater.
What do you find?
You find a perfectly organized, fully functioning, hyper-modern metropolis, complete with paved roads, skyscrapers, a power grid, and traffic lights.
An explosion of order, not chaos. A glass of water reassembling itself from an explosion. And the number Penrose calculated to quantify this, the precision required to hit this exact state. I know we threw around 10 to the 120 earlier, but this is the number I really want you to brace yourself for.
It's massive.
Penrose calculated the odds to be 1 part in 10 to the power of 10 to the power of 123.
We must be extraordinarily clear about what that number means mathematically. That is not 10 to the 123. That is a double exponent.
Meaning what?
It means it is a 1 followed not by 123 zeros. It is a 1 followed by 10 to the 123rd power zeros.
Wow.
To understand how impossible it is to even write this number down, If you were to try and write it out in full, and you decided to write a zero on every single proton, neutron, and electron in the entire observable universe.
All 10 to the 80 of them?
Yes. You would run out of matter in the universe to write on long before you even made a fraction of a percent of a dent in writing the zeros. It is a number that completely defies physical representation. It breaks the concept of probability.
Which naturally forces us to stop and ask, how do we even begin to grasp something that incomprehensible? We need a completely different scale just to talk about it.
We really do.
The source uses this nested universes thought experiment to try and make Penrose's number tangible. And I want to slow down and walk you through it carefully, because this is what really locked the sheer weight of this concept into place for me.
It's a necessary mental exercise, because without grasping the scale of this improbability, you can't understand why the author definitively rejects the idea that our universe is a product of chance.
Okay, so let's build the scale organically. A million seconds is about 11 days. A billion seconds is roughly 31 years. A trillion seconds is 31,000 years. We are already losing our intuitive grasp.
Yeah, our brains aren't built for it.
Now, jump to 10 to the power of 80. That is the estimated number of every single atom in the entire observable universe. All the billions of galaxies, all the trillions of stars, every speck of dust.
Yeah.
10 to the 80. Now, to visualize Penrose's number, the author asks you to imagine that every single one of those 10 to the 80 atoms in our universe is actually an entire universe itself, just as big and full of atoms as ours.
A staggering expansion of scale, an infinity of infinites.
But we aren't done. Now, you have to go inside all those nested universes, look at all the atoms inside them, and imagine that every single one of those atoms is also a full-sized universe. It's a fractal of reality. Universes within atoms within universes.
It's hard to even picture.
Now, if you somehow counted up the total number of individual atoms across all of those exponentially nested universes combined, all of them, you would still fall incomprehensibly short of Penrose's number. You wouldn't even be close to hitting the probability of our universe's initial low-entropy state occurring by unguided chance.
This is the absolute crux of the issue. When a mathematical probability reaches this level of infinitesimal smallness, it stops being a probability in any practical scientific sense. It represents a physical impossibility.
So what does this all mean? Because the obvious pushback, and this is the argument I hear all the time, the one I naturally lean toward when faced with numbers like this, is the multiverse, or the lottery argument.
The multiverse.
People say, look, someone has to win the lottery. The odds of me winning the Powerball are mathematically terrible, but eventually some guy in Ohio buys the right ticket.
Right.
Couldn't we just have won a cosmic lottery? If there's an infinite multiverse out there bubbling up new random universes forever and ever, eventually one of them is going to hit that one blue dot on the phase space grid. Right? And we just happen to be in the lucky blue dot universe because we couldn't exist in the dead red dot universes to ask the question.
This raises an important question about epistemology, you know, how we know what we know and what constitutes a valid scientific explanation. The author tackles the multiverse argument head on.
What do they say?
The text argues that at this extreme level of statistical impossibility, invoking an infinite number of unseen universes to explain away fine-tuning ceases to be a valid mathematical or scientific explanation. It becomes an evasion.
But why is it an evasion? If the multiverse is infinite, doesn't it guarantee our existence?
Let's use an analogy. The text brings up the concept of a casino. Imagine you walk into a casino and sit down at a poker table. The dealer shuffles the deck and deals himself a royal flush.
Wow. Okay.
You might say, wow, the odds of that are terrible, but what a lucky chance. But if that dealer deals himself a royal flush 20 hands in a row, you don't sit there and say, well, there must be an infinite number of casinos in the multiverse, and I just happen to be sitting in the one where this naturally occurred.
No, I grab my chips and run because I say the game is rigorously rigged, the dealer is cheating, this is by design. But let me fight you on this. Let me fight for the materialist perspective for a second. In the casino, we know human cheaters exist. We know sleight of hand is real. We don't have empirical evidence of a cosmic cheater or a grand designer.
Mm.
Isn't positing an infinite multiverse, which is just more of the physics we already know, mathematically safer and more scientific than positing a conscious deity outside of space and time?
That is exactly the tension. But the author argues that the multiverse explanation forces us to abandon the very foundations of rational scientific inference. It requires us to postulate an infinite machine churning out unobservable realities just to avoid a teleological conclusion in the one reality we can observe.
So it's a cop-out.
The multiverse doesn't actually explain the fine-tuning, it just tries to mathematically drown it. Furthermore, if you invoke an infinite multiverse where everything possible happens, it destroys scientific predictability.
How does it do that?
In an infinite multiverse, there are universes where gravity randomly stops working tomorrow. There are universes where your brain spontaneously assembled from dust 5 seconds ago, complete with false memories, what physicists call a Boltzmann brain. If the multiverse is true, you have no reason to trust your own scientific observations.
Wow. If everything is possible, then nothing means anything. If you break probability, you break science.
Precisely.
So if chance, unguided physics, and even the multiverse are mathematically or logically inadequate to explain this setup, if they literally break the equations, what is the cumulative verdict the author draws from all this data?
The synthesis of all these independent data points from Chapter 1 relies on multiplying these factors together. When you have independent requirements, the matter-antimatter asymmetry, the strength of gravity, the beryllium resonance of the strong nuclear force, the cosmological constant, the 3D spatial dimension, and Penrose's initial entropy, you must multiply their probabilities to get the cumulative probability of the entire system.
And the author uses something called the principle of indifference to weigh these probabilities.
Right.
I want to make sure we define that clearly.
Yeah. The principle of indifference is a foundational concept in probability theory. It states that in the absence of any evidence to the contrary, all mutually exclusive possibilities should be assigned equal probabilities.
Like rolling a die.
Exactly. If you have a standard six-sided die and no reason to believe it's weighted, you assume a 1 in 6 chance for each side. The author applies this to the cosmos. If there is no underlying physical law forcing the cosmological constant to be exactly 10 to the 120, we must assume it could have been any value.
Which makes the fact that it landed exactly on the life-permitting value astronomically improbable.
Exactly. And when you multiply all these astronomical improbabilities together, the author's ultimate claim is this. The universe isn't just a passive, neutral backdrop where a biological life happened to accidentally arise through a series of lucky breaks. Yes, the universe actively acts as a highly specific set of preconditions. It is so precisely calibrated for chemistry and observers that the calibration itself demands a causal explanation.
And the author's explanation is intelligent design.
Yeah.
But they are very careful about how they frame this epistemologically, aren't they?
Yes, and this is perhaps the most critical distinction in the entire text. The author argues that concluding intelligent design in this specific cosmological context is not a religious leap of faith, and it is absolutely not a God of the gaps fallacy.
Right, a God of the gaps fallacy happens when people look at a mystery and say, science doesn't know how lightning works, therefore Zeus is throwing bolts from the sky. It's using God to fill in ignorance.
Precisely. But the author forcefully argues the exact opposite is happening here. The inference to design and cosmic fine-tuning is not based on what we don't know about physics. It is heavily based on what we do know.
Okay, unpack that.
We know exactly what unguided high-energy explosions produce. Thermal equilibrium and chaos. We know exactly what the equations of general relativity dictate. We know exactly what physical constants are required for carbon-based life.
So it's based on positive, empirical knowledge of what unguided matter can't do and what intelligence can do.
That is the core argument. The text argues this is a standard, universally accepted application of historical science. If a team of archaeologists is digging in a desert and they find a smooth, rounded stone, they naturally attribute its shape to unguided natural forces like wind and water erosion.
Right.
But if they dig a little deeper and find a perfectly chipped, symmetrically carved flint arrowhead, they immediately and unanimously infer that a conscious mind created it.
Why? Because wind doesn't carve arrowheads.
Because the arrowhead exhibits what we call highly specified improbable complexity. Or consider the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI. Astronomers listen to radio waves from space all the time.
Just listening to the static.
Right. If they receive a signal that is just random static or a repeating pulse, they assume it's a natural phenomenon like a pulsar. But if a radio telescope received a signal transmitting the first 50 prime numbers in perfect sequential order,
the entire scientific community would instantly agree it was sent by an intelligent alien mind.
Mm.
Because prime numbers are a specific target. A burning star doesn't sequentially spit out prime numbers.
No,
it requires semantic information. It requires a mind that understands the concept of indivisibility.
Exactly. The author is simply taking this exact same universally accepted scientific logic and applying it to the foundational structure of the cosmos. finding highly specified, mathematically improbable complexity like Penrose's 10 to the 10 to the 123 initial entropy state or the hypercalibrated resonance of the Hoyle state empirically points to a conscious mind in the exact same way a prime number signal points to an alien intelligence.
It really flips the script on how this entire debate is usually framed in popular culture. The author is basically asserting that it's not that science is lacking an explanation for the universe's highly ordered origin.
Right.
It's that science has found their explanation that intelligence is the only known observable cause of highly specified algorithmic complexity, and that the purely materialist paradigm is simply refusing to accept the data because the philosophical implications of a designer are unpalatable.
That's the author's stance, yes.
Now, again, to our listeners, we aren't telling you this is the absolute truth or demanding you drop your worldview. We are just presenting the author's rigorous, mathematically backed argument. The argument that the target was painted long before the arrow was ever shot.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Chapter 1's cosmic framework acts as the ultimate prerequisite for all other scientific mysteries.
The foundation of everything.
Well, yes. Before you can even begin to debate how biology evolved or how DNA assembled itself in some warm little pond on a primordial Earth, you are forced to acknowledge that the pond, the planet, the sun providing the warmth, and the very carbon atoms themselves only exist because they are balancing on a spire of mathematical precision so narrow that it defies human imagination.
Which perfectly wraps up our journey today. Let's look back at the sheer scale of what we've covered. We started with the fundamental survival of matter, that miraculous 1 in a billion extra proton that survived the antimatter annihilation.
We did.
We navigated the razor's edge of the four fundamental forces, learning how a millimeter turn of the strong nuclear dial prevents carbon from ever existing, and how tweaking gravity explodes the stars. We tried to balance the pencil on the bullet train during the earthquake of the 10 to the 120 cosmological constant.
A very bumpy ride.
And finally, we confronted the incomprehensible precision of the Big Bang's initial entropy, the 1 in 10 to the 10 to the 123 chance that a hydrogen bomb detonation naturally creates a perfectly functioning metropolis. You, the listener, your very ability to process this audio right now, your very existence is perched on top of that impossibly narrow spire.
And as we close, I want to leave you with one final mind-expanding idea inspired by the text's linking of foundational cosmology and information theory. We've talked extensively about how the initial, highly ordered state of the universe acts almost like a compressed ZIP file of instructions.
A cosmic ZIP file.
Yes. A file containing the precise setup, the energy gradients, and the mathematical parameters for everything that followed over the next 13.8 billion years. It was all loaded at the beginning.
Okay, I'm with you.
If the laws of physics are just the software producing the output of stars, planets, and eventually complex chemistry, what kind of computational hardware is running that file? Yep. We spend so much of our scientific energy focused on studying the stars and the atoms, which is just analyzing the output on the screen. But perhaps the real origin enigma isn't found by dissecting the output. Perhaps it is found by trying to imagine the underlying machine, the causal reality, that was actively processing the code of reality before time and space even existed.
That is something incredibly profound to ponder tonight as you look up at the night sky. Think about that shattered glass of water from our introduction. According to the deepest, most fundamental laws of unguided physics, the universe should just be a cold, dark puddle of chaotic radiation on the floor.
But it's not.
But instead, here we are. We are sitting here, holding the perfectly formed glass. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.